What I will talk to you, first of all, I should thank the organizers for getting the opportunity of coming here. I mean, I'm looking forward to this week of discussing things with theorists and other experimentalists. I think it would be a really good setting for doing this. About last week, I mean, also we were told to come up with a more fan-catchy title than the ones that were given in the initial program. And I think this in some sense tells what the Brahms experiment has achieved so far, namely that we have been looking at some of the global observables and some of the charged hadronic observable at RIC. So I'll give a very brief introduction, and I will go through items basically in, I should really focus so everybody can see. I will talk about two aspects of the Brahms data, namely the global observables, and what I'm going to show you is basically all published. It's from the two different energies, it's charged particle multiplicity measurements, and it is comparisons to a couple of different models. On the hadronic spectra, or the charged hadronic spectra and particle information, this is published data, and it's also some work in progress. Several of you, some of this work was shown already a couple of weeks ago, and some of you may know of it, but I know this is a fairly broad group, and I think it's good to have a chance to see it in perspective. I've actually talked very little about the experiment, more about the data, particle ratios, particle spectras, and comparison, and some summary. So what maybe in this group it's still worth to remind everybody that when the RIC was proposed as an accelerator and the experiments were proposed, the whole program was also set up so that as many aspects as possible of the whole program could be covered by the RIC experiments. And so in this sense, I mean, the Brahms experiments is one of the two small experiments, but it also has a few dedicated goals. And so the goals particularly that were set up to study is reaction mechanism and dynamics, and baryon stopping, and particle production over a large rapidity range. And I think already about 6, 7, 8 years ago, it was becoming clear that going to intermediate PT ranges was also an important part of the physics, and we could learn from it, and I think we all know we are starting to learn something from it. This is done through precision measurements or wide rapidity range, and the goal was to reach into the fragmentation region. It's not quite possible at RIC to do this, but it gets pretty close. And so one question I asked myself about where is the connection to QCD, we were asked to come up with some thoughts about where is the connection. And I certainly think we have learned that I find there's considerable interest when we look at the baryon stopping. This can possibly learn us about baryon junctions, about QCD effects that we have to understand to get to this piece. I think, as I said, the intermediate PT identified hadrons are interesting. It's possible that even in the basic simple particle yields, like the charged particle distribution, energy dependence, rapidity dependence, that when I actually see traces, even though, as many of us know, it's not a straightforward thing to see the difference between different descriptions, but I think it all is there, and I think it's important to get to an overall consistent picture of all the data that are emerging. So with this said, let me go to the global observables in Brahms, namely the measurements of GN charts, the eta, and this is certainly it's one of the topics that other speakers will come back to during this week. So this is one aspect of what we will see. So what one can hope, what the particle number of particles produced is clearly related to the entropy production. We can see when we study the distributions, there's an issue whether hadronic reinteractions, how do the basic shapes come? Do the hadronic reinteractions change these shapes? It was proposed that one could learn about relative contribution, relative importance of soft and hadronic interactions. And one can study this looking at the centrality and energy dependence. And it was put forward that there's sensitivity to shadowing and jet quenching. This, of course, sounds very ambitious, and it requires an interplay between experimentalists and theorists. So one of the things we have to live with in real experiments and not Gedanken experiments is the matter of nuclear collision geometry. And this shows one of the complications we have as experimentalists, not only when we want to look at our own data, but also when we want to compare with both the theory and with between different experiments. So let me just illustrate how we have been addressing this in our global measurements. Let me start by depicting a small subset of the actual experimental apparatus which is used to measure the global observables. So this is as close as you get to a picture of the experiment. The beams are coming down from opposite direction. The collisions point is inside this barrel. Around this barrel, there's actually two kinds of barrels. There's one detector of silicon. There's another detector of scintillators, which covers approximately plus minus 2 in pseudo-rapidity. Then there are a set of detectors that sits at large pseudo-rapidities, which covers forward, backward, emerging particles. And due to the extended vertex that one has in the collisions, they do not actually all happen at zero. They happen so on extended range. You can actually, not on an event-by-event basis, but on an average basis, you can get the NDATA distributions. Then as a further last detector, this is not a detector meant to do multiplicity, but it's a tracking detector that sits close to it. And it's a fourth detector by which, from the measurement in that detector, one can actually cross-check that the measurements done through the other set is consistent and the things hang together. So out of these detectors, what you measured, this, for instance, gives the correlation between what is plotted here as multiplicity of particles now in normalized units in one set of detectors, namely the inner ones, correlated with the multiplicities in the high pseudo-rapidity detectors. And you do see they are clearly correlated. So when you look at these distributions, then you go from the peripheral collisions to the central collisions, and now we define percentages of the cross sections by basically normalizing this distribution to the known nuclear cross section or to the extrapolated cross section. So the yields are being normalized. There's a small fraction of quite peripheral collisions that are not detected in the system, so one uses extensive Monte Carlo simulations to correct for this. So based on this, one defines event classes corresponding to the most central, and you will hear this nomenclature in percentages. So we go from 0 to 5 up to 40 to 50%. So the other quantity that is being used in describing this kind of data is, I have to mention this, but I won't spend a lot of time on it. It's the number of participants, and what is meant by the number of participants is essentially the number of the nucleons in the two incident projectiles which are interacting in the collision. This is, of course, not something you measure. This is something you deduce, and here one you have to rely on a Glauber model or Glauber-like models to evaluate what these numbers are, and this is how it is generically done, and there has been several workshops dedicated to just figuring out how you do that, and it's not completely clear how to do it. Let me show you some example of the measurements. These are 130 MeV, so what is shown here is versus pseudo rapidity in the distributions, as shown the DN charge as for the different centrality classes. So there are two things I want to. So this is the most central, the peripheral. So first, the general structure of the distribution is they're quite wide, plus minus 6 units of pseudo rapidity, and they're flat over plus minus roughly 2 units. So this is the physics, and I will come back to what we learned from this. The other thing I want to impress to you is how the different detector systems, in fact, show up to be consistent between the measurements. So there are different color codes, which you may not be able to see, but the most forward detectors are responsible for these measurements, the inner barrels for the ones in the middle, and the red dots here are, so to speak, selected checkpoints from the independent detector, and they're all quite consistent. So in order to, since we know that the gold-gold collisions are symmetric, in order to reduce some of the systematic systematic errors, we symmetrize the data when we are looking at them further. So this is what is done here for the 130 GeV data, and I should apologize because I'm afraid the colors don't show up too well in the back. This is now plotted from 0 to 6 in pseudo rapidity. So this is the central region, and you see two sets of curves. What is done now to the DND eta in order to compare them on a common scale is that you take the DND eta as is measured, and you divide it by the number of participants pair in the collision to bring them on a common footing. This enables you also to allow between different collisions, centralities between different particles, between different reactions, and so on. And so this is the so-called the scaled pseudorapidity densities, the DND eta divided by 2 times the number of particles. And what you've plotted here is a peripheral collision. Peripheral, the 30 to 40%. And when you go to the most central bins, you do see a significant increase in the data. When you go to the forward pseudo rapidities, there's no significant change in these measurements. So let me just show you the summary of the data for the 200 GeV data. This is the same set of centrality bins from peripheral to the most central. You see there are two observations, and we'll come back to those. One is that the Whistle distributions are getting wider, and that the multiplicity increases when you go at this mid-rapidity, when you go from 130 to 200, but they do in fact not increase very much. And I think it's one of the interests to try to understand better why, in some sense, this number is so relatively small. This has certainly been reason for a lot of speculation. So in some sense now, what I'm going to show you next is the multiplicity data, but it's kind of digested, but in different ways. Because what we have measured now, we have them in three parameters. We have them as function of two energies. We have them as function of pseudo rapidity and as function of centrality. And so what you will see in the next couple of slides is the data just cut in different ways and the focus on a few different aspects of the data.
Can I ask a quick
Sure.
You said that you determine the number of participants who are hyperinsulin.
Yes.
This is then the fact that you see a strong change of number of charged particles per participant, just a reflection of the fact that this is what comes out of hyperinsulin.
No, I could do that with any cloud, with a Glauber model, right? I don't have, I mean, I think many of us say we use hygiene, but in fact it's not hygiene per se, it's really the Glauber part of it, right? Well, I mean, it's done in, I would call, quote, standard way, right, that you it is done in a, within hygiene, you calculate as function of impact parameter, you calculate the number of participants, and you do that over an impact parameter range that is bigger than the size of the nucleus, that makes sure that you get the full nuclear cross section. You can now plot this versus in participant, and you split your groups in percentages. Starting from, say, from the top 0 to 5, 5 to 10, and you calculate the average number of participants that the model gives you in each of these bins. Do I have a way of checking this with an experiment? Experiment, I think I cannot, there's a couple, I mean, no, you cannot check this in the, well, there are a couple of quantities that is very easy to use theoretically, namely n participant and also impact parameter. And both of these are not they're not an observable you can measure. You can only, but there is probably a correlation. I mean, that's why we're trying to find correlations, in the sense that once, if we demonstrate that there is a correlation between the mean number of participants and the DN charge data, then we can later on, if we believe in that, then we can turn the arguments around, and now we can measure the multiplicity and say this represents it in part. I mean, that's one way one can think about using it.
I think people are just trying to ask how you normalize the calculation to your data.
No, that's not well. No.
So you're really looking for them always the same size.
No.
What you're doing is you're mapping percentages of the total cross section in data to percentages of the total cross section in the model. And then you're using a certain model to translate that into the number of
data. Yes, yes. Yeah. Yes. Could maybe I could get the chance to continue. I mean, I don't want to leave. I mean, it's an important issue, and I think maybe we'll hear more about it. Is that right, Peter? No? Okay. Let me show you what I think is the most interesting recent result of what has come out, and this is the energy dependence on the distributions, and again what is now. So these are our final numbers, namely the charged DN data at mid rapidity, the 130 and the 200 GeV. And so what we observe is that there's an increase plus 13% plus minus 4% in DN data for the most central collisions in the two Rigg energies. And what I want to show in this panel to the right is really how does this increase vary as function of pseudo rapidity as well as per centrality. And so this is versus pseudo rapidity, and you see it's the the increase is fairly constant over a fairly wide range of superrapidities in the order of 2. And when you get to the high rapidity, it increases. And the say about the similar increase is actually observed in the other bins. It happens to be that I had to take these curves with the data with the curves. I mean, this is the curves is, this is a prediction by Dima and Levine. Dima and Nardi, sorry. And Dima kindly provided all the numbers to us so we could plot them on the same scale with the right percentages. And the dashed lines is the prediction by the AMPT calculation by Chuang and Li. This is it, what is plotted here, is the ratio between the 200 and 130 GeV data. And you see it's about this, I mean the scale is kind of compressed, right, but is so if you take it over this range, the average is about 1.14.
So part of your effect must be that there's a broader, there's a broader rapidity range.
Sure. I'm not saying this is necessarily profound. I've actually shown that one slide that is not profound, but I mean, actually, to me, the more interesting piece is actually that you want to see that the increase in the yield is fairly constant or a fairly broad range, which I think it again tells us that we do have, I mean, this is one or many indication that we have a fairly wide plateau in the center where things behave more or less identical as you look at different properties. Let me just illustrate a question that Hemmig, Thomas raised, namely that when you do look at the high rapidities, one way to see what happens here is that if you take the distributions and compare them to the translation to the reference frame of the beam. So you plot them versus eta prime, which is eta minus y beam. And then you can plot various set of data. This has been done. I mean, in a sense, it's an old story. It started out with emulsion data at different energies. And it is basically known that when you are in the region around the y beam, you see essentially the same properties independent on collision systems and independent on energy. So this is what is called consisting with the limited fragmentation. So again, I mean, it also shows that when you look at specific issues, one has to be, you really have to compare things quite detailed. Let me just show another way of displaying the same two models in regard to the data, namely the Casseus and Levine's gluon saturation model and the AMPT. And this is the 200 GeV data. This is now the raw DNDA tests that are plotted versus.
What is AMPT?
I don't know what this particular thing. I can tell you the model. I should actually spend at least a minute on it because I'm going to refer to it later. It's a cascade model. It starts with the initial conditions in the sense it takes the Heiting model. So it's a string model with appropriate. It can have turn the same kind of patterns on and off. And then it has built on top of that, it has thus rescattering in the final phase. So it's trying to, it is looking at the effect, it includes effect of rescattering after the initial collisions. And this is in fact one of the reasons why the model, which is also shown here as a dash, is in fact do describe the data, because this rescattering effect widens the distributions a little bit. Yes. But you see, in general, so in some sense that it's the same. The full drawn line is Dima's model because I knew he was here. No, it's not the reason. And the dashed line is the empty. The stars. The stars in this particular plot. This is the scaled PP data from UA. So it really, it's kind of in a direct way demonstrates the increase from going from PP to gold data. Okay, I should move on to. Let me keep this one just for later. This would be a long answer. What error bars, right? There are different error bars. there are statisticals, there are systematics that has to do with taking radios, and there's systematics point per point, and then there's all normalization systematics, right? And for some of this discussion where we compare two energies, for the energy comparison, I mean, we believe the systematic error is 4%, that's clearly the dominating. If you were talking about the overall magnitude of the DND data, it is 8 to 9%. Let me go to the 25. Well, let me go to the hadronic spectra, and again, since it's experimental talk, I have to show you just one or two things. What we are focusing on so far, what we have analyzed from the data to some detail, is the particle ratios of p bar to p's, which certainly has relations to the Sparian stopping, and as it was discussed just a couple of weeks ago. I'll show some model comparisons. I will say a few words about the other particle ratios that we have, and I'll show some spectra which shows what is really what will come in the future. I should just tell you that one of the challenges that we have had in the experiment is really how do we identify hadrons to up to very large momenta. And this is, I have no intention to going through this, but you must understand that the experiment consists of it does not measure everything on an event basis. It measures with a little telescope. It looks at the reaction and identifies a few particles for each event. So this is done through a spectrometer that measures momenta and does particle identification, and it is movable from these angles to slightly bigger angles. And in this way, we can cover the pseudo-rapidity range. So the data has, in the end, to be pieced together by many independent measurements. So there are many things that people sometimes is asked, what can you do? Can you do baryon, anti-baryon fluctuations with high rapidity? The answer is no, because it's not done on an event-by-event basis. Just to acknowledge some of the nice work that has been done by our collaborators, this is various ways of that we identify particles with a time of flight in the mid-rapidity, identifying pions, kaons, protons, and you can see we can identify protons easily up to about 40. In the forward region, we have a so-called ring imaging Cherenkov detector, which identifies other particles as function momenta. You see we now go up to 25 GeV, and you see pions, kaons, protons. This particular plot is pieced together with several different settings, but it kind of shows the capability of the experiment. I have to show you this plot not because I want to identify, but I want to make sure you understand that the particle ratios that are presented in some of the subsequent slides, they do not come from, at present, they do not come from taking spectra at specific rapidities and looking at the yields, but they really come from the basic measurements with the residual cut, and this shows what is seen in this given momentum setting. So as functional rapidity, and transverse momentum. It shows the colored band is where protons are being identified. So things are being picked up. Say, particularly when you get to the large rapidity, you do not measure at a single rapidity or PT, but the measurement is an average over part of this region, not the whole region, but part typically in the order of 0.3 to 0.4 units of rapidity. And this is as things are now, but they will change in the future. They will though not change for the data that was taken with 130 GeV, and this is published data. And what this shows is this is now centrality and PT dependence of the particle ratios. And what we see here in this panel is plotted the number of P bars over P versus centrality. And it's the red dots are, this is at mid rapidity, namely corresponding to rapidity 0 and rapidity 0.7, and then at a forward rapidity. And you see it is essentially flat with centrality in this centrality range. In PT, which goes up to 2, I mean, the error bars are big, but all the data essentially consistent with that. There's no PT dependence of the data. The forward rapidity data are all at lower PT. So what was seen here was that the P bar to P was 0.64, and the K plus to K minus to K plus 0.9. So how does this look at, you go to the 200 GeV data, now it's preliminary data, but it's data that has stayed in the same form for quite a while. This is, for 200 GeV, this is now plotted versus centrality, is now the ratios of different particle species, namely the pions, the kaons, and the P bar to P at mid rapidity. So again, the centrality range is quite small. It's only up to 25%, but it's essentially constant. If you look at the average of the P bar to P, it's now 0.75 with a 5% systematic error. When you look at it versus transverse, well, it's actually this is versus transverse momentum, and you see that it is fairly it's also no real centrality dependence. It's transverse momentum dependent. Sorry. One of the things that we can do in the experiments is to look at the rapidity dependence, and this is now for the three different particle species. This is probably better. The pion ratios, the kaon ratios, the P bar to P, and this is a 200 GeV data, this is the 130 GeV data, and you essentially see that this ratio is, again, this now is almost constant, it's basically constant over plus minus one unit of rapidity, affirming what I said before, that I think we do have a nice zone in the middle of the reaction where things do not change a lot, and things fall down as you go to the higher rapidity and becomes more baryon, slightly more baryon rich. One question one can ask, is this kind of change with rapidity consistent with what you would expect from, does the different particle yields, are they consistent if you think about this in a thermal description? And this has not been completed, but let me just show one example, namely, if you look at the 130 GeV data, what has been compared here is now the particle yields of kaons relative to the particle yields of of the P bar to P, which directly relates to the baryon chemical potential for, this is a model by Picatinny et al. Actually, the figure is taken directly out of their publication. And what is plotted is the 130 GeV data is plotted at our measured data point for the P bar to P at mid-rapidity and the equivalent kaon ratios. And you go to the more forward rapidity, which in this case was around 2, where the ratio drops to 0.4. And you see that the measurement in the K plus to K minus that we measured there is actually consistent. So when you go from the mid rapidity region up to the forward region, you increase the baryon chemical potential, I mean, expectedly. But I mean, this kind of simple measurements can give you a quantitative value of what it actually is. These data are inclusive, right? Within reason, this is another, let's not spend the whole time. Within reasonable assumption of lambda to lambda bar in our spectrometer, the effect on the ratios is very small. I think that's a fair way of saying it. I mean, you could put in very strange assumption, and then you would see an effect. But within reasonable values, you do not see an effect in the way the spectrometer works. It's not done. I think there are experts here who really can tell you what these thermal models are doing. But they look at basically a hadron gas with different chemical potentials and temperatures, and then they evaluate what the different particle yields is, and they do a remarkable good job and from low energies to all the way to Rick. You can actually, it's one of the puzzles. Why is it things not more different? I mean, it's all we are seeing is that final state properties. You should probably soon show me a sign, right? No, I'm not particularly nervous. I think one of the things that we looked at when we got the 130 GeV data, I think one of the real puzzles, that one of the initial puzzles when one compared data to, say, string models like Huygens or even other models, was that it was not possible to get really a consistent picture between the relatively low particle production at mid rapidity, which, say, Huygens does quite well, and the baryon ratios over the full range. In a sense, it's like with the P bar to P ratio is at the one energy is 164 and the other one is 75. I mean, even though it's fairly baryon free with a low baryon chemical potential, it is still a surprising amount of net baryons in mid rapidity, which has been a puzzle. So I don't want to dwell on that, but let me just illustrates what I just said. If you look at, so this shows the NDATA, this shows the P bar to P ratio. If you take a model, for instance, which is plotted here, like Huygens, which described the charged particle distribution quite well, and then you look at where it showed up in the description of the P bar to P ratio, it would be way off, and you could find other models that would do the reverse thing. So this is one of the things that points to that one really has to look at data in the overall feature. Let me show you one thing which may possibly explain this, and this is one example. This is actually from, so what is plotted here is against the Brahms data as function of rapidity, and so this is a P bar to P ratio, and this is compared now with the with the AMPT model, with the modified hygiene. And I think, so it is modified in a couple of ways, right? As we heard, some of us heard a couple of weeks ago, I mean, it is modified by a mechanism which he calls a popcorn, but I think this is certainly has resemblance to the baryon junctions models that transports baryons to the mid-rapidity. And then it has rescattering. In particular, I find one of the important rescatterings that is actually included is that when you have this hadronic gas of pions, you know that you can have a backscattering into the P-bar P channels. So the question is how to deal with that, because I mean, I think you ask in the series, they'll tell you it's very hard to calculate in a cascade-like model 7 pions or 6 pions going to 2 nucleons. But in this case, it's done by simulating through rows and omegas, which makes it into a two-body problem. And I think it does a remarkable description of the data as it stands now. Let me. Yeah, let me just show you the energy dependence of the P bar to P ratios as summarizes most of the data. This is now what is plotted here is a square root of S. And now it's a combination of, I shouldn't say all the world's data. For Rick, I only plotted the Brahms data. I think all four Rick experiments has measured this ratio at 130. And they agree quite well in the range of 0.6 to 0.68. These are data from very low energy. What is plotted here is the ISR PP data going to the ratio P bar to P. And this is increased at the higher energy. So I think I already said this. I mean, there's a last asymmetry. So it was also brought up, I mean, can we, this kind of energy dependence, is this something that we can learn from? And I think it is, but it's clear that it requires a lot of systematics. Let me just show one example. This is actually Dima, he proposed a long time ago, but I mean, he reiterated on last week that if you want to, this is the P bar ratio versus the square root center mass, and this is now for PP data. So I'm taking a step back from AA and seeing what can we learn from PP. And if you go to his physics letters, it was not a prescription, a description, and of kind of he tried to calculate a component in the stopping of baryons that would be dominate at the very high energy, namely, if I get it right, it's a 1 Pomeroy exchange. So it has this square S dependence, which goes as S to the minus 1/4, and it is a very slow effect, which would make the baryon, net baryon number higher. And you can see, in fact, as function of square root of S, it does not increase quite as fast as the data, but it does indicate to the points to the direction to why one might have low values at this at RIG also. That things are not, there are also things that one should pay in mind, that one can clearly not just look at these simple kind of ratios. If you go to the PP data, they're clear. If you take the P bar to P ratios in from an ISR, they're clear. These are from this experiment. And they're different, the curves are fit to the different energies done by Hans Bürgel. And they clearly show, I mean, they're clearly PT dependencies in the data at the PP, which we have not seen in the AA. Let me. Let me show a few more. I just want to show one preliminary result we have from the 200 GeV data, namely when we look at non-equal particle ratios, and this is now just the acceptance corrected and versus PT, and what you see, what is plotted is the K Okay, minus the pi minus versus pt, the p bar to pi minus versus pt, and we see the observation that was noted already by Phoenix in the 130 GeV data, that when you, as you go to high transverse momenta, the heavier masses really dominate the particle spectra, and in particular when you get up to about 2 GeV, the p bar are as important as the pions, and this is clearly an interesting feature. Let me, I should show you one other result. This is now, it illustrates that transverse spectra, in fact, also are important. I mean, this is clearly the step what we want to achieve, but this is for rapidity. For mid-rapidity, it shows the p-bars, kaons, and pions versus mt, and the spectra are, as a couple of observations, which other people have also done. I mean, the spectra are certainly not, even the pions, they are not exponential in mt. When you go to, even in mt, as you go to the higher mt values, the heavier particles become more dominant. And just for reference, I think one of the issues that one should think about, what can we learn here? And I think this has certainly also been addressed in recent papers. I mean, is at least what comes to mind is, are these spectra, are they describable by relatively simple rescattering and, quote, radial flow mechanisms, or are there other degrees of freedom are important that has been proposed? Can they be described in a much simpler way, starting with a basal gluonic degree of freedom? And I think as an experimentalist, one of the questions I certainly ask myself is, I mean, how can we really distinguish between these two? What are the ways to really pin this down that one can say this is not trivial? So let me summarize. I think I showed you already in the plots. I think I will, let me just give you a precursor of what I think that you will see from the Brahms experiment as it moves more forward, what comes out of the data that we took last year. And so this is what I think we will get. We will measure, you'll get identified spectra for centralities in this range between 0 and 25. We will do it over rapidities between 0 and 3 at a good number of selected rapidities. At mid-rapidity, we'll be able to get proton and p-bar spectra up to about 4 GeV over C. And thus, we also get the net baryon rapidity distribution. As you probably know, there was also a short run with PP at 200 GeV from Rick. And for that, we will get modest PT values. We will get comparison data so one can compare the basic particle production in PP with that of gold. And I mean, it's already known, but the hadron spectra in PP are much softer than they are in AA. And the mean PTs are much less. You don't even have to do much. You just look at the spectrum. Sorry? This is just an observation, right? I mean, well, I put it in this modest. You call it modest. I think I put it modest because I do not have any data to back it up. But I say this is just an observation. I don't have a spectrum to show you, right? Yeah. So that is basically it. I think there's the question. I mean, I think one of the things that I, in many ways, I find is interesting. And how do we really learn? What is interesting physics? Interesting underlying physics here, and what is kind of trivial? I mean, in some sense, in some sense, how do we disentangle the nuclear mess and the reaction mess from what we want to study? Thank you. Speak up so everybody can hear it.
Because this aircraft, which you have measured, right, have this proton going with a different flow, and that is not what's happening in CTE. And this is not what was expected from jets, because jets don't produce bions. They like to produce neutrons, but they don't like to produce bions. In CTE and the plus and minus, there are much less bions, especially at light CTE, because jets don't produce them. In this case, there are more bions than neutrons. So it is, you know, I would say this is covered. And of course, it is only, I think, some collective motion like hydro can do.
No, but it's something, I mean, it's a whole, I mean, there's more to the story than that, right, in the sense that this was first seen at very low energies. I mean, you also see a low, I mean, even at AGS and SPS energies, you see this evolution from going from PP to AA with hardening of the spectra.
Well,
yeah.
Well,
we're
going to have to
do
the
I think people are looking forward to lunch.